Good evening. Thank you for coming out this evening. Welcome to another season of the Michigan Writers Series here at the State University Libraries. My name is Peter Berg. I'm head of Special Collections, and I'm the coordinator, along with Stephanie Matheson and Michael Rodriguez, of the series. We're delighted you're here. Our fall schedule is set, and the green flyer is available for you. All the other people coming up for the fall are listed here and the dates. I'll also remind you that everything that is done for the Michigan Writers Series is recorded and digitized and put up on the World Wide Web. And so if you want to hear tonight's reading or the readings of the past, you're welcome to do that by just going to your computer and dialing in our URL, which is given on the green flyer. And we hope you you will enjoy the reading and of past and present. We're delighted this year to have Schuler Books and Music as a supporter of the Michigan Writers Series. They have generously provided their support, and also they, for certain writers, will be making their books available. And for Mr. Holden's appearance tonight, books by Mr. Holden are available by Schuler Books outside the door, and you're welcome to purchase those after the reading. We're very pleased tonight to welcome Craig Holden to Michigan State University. Toledo native Craig Holden published his first novel, The River Sorrow, in 1994, after having spent several years working as a film rights agent. The success of the book allowed Holden to begin writing full-time, and his second novel, The Last Sanctuary, appeared in 1996. His third book, Four Corners of the Night, met with tremendous critical acclaim, garnering him the 1999 Great Lakes Book Award for Fiction and making the USA Today bestseller list. Holden's fourth novel, The Jazz Bird, a fictionalized account of the 1920s Cincinnati Society murder, was published in 2000, and he is currently at work on a new book. Mr. Holden received his Bachelor of Arts degree from the University of Toledo and his Master of Fine Arts degree from the University of Montana. Please join me in welcoming Craig Holden.
Thank you. Thank you, Peter. That was nice. I'm just still deciding what to read. I don't know. Let me ask first, how many people have read The Jazz Bird? Or has anybody? Not many. Okay. I might read more from that. I'm just thirsty. I'm actually teaching it for the first time. I'm teaching a class at Michigan this semester, University of Michigan. So we pulled in on campus. My son's with me. He's 7. He said, why is it green and white here? I mean, he just couldn't figure out. I said, well, you know how it's blue and yellow down there? I said, they're green and white up here, Michigan State. He said, Emma, that's his sister. Emma hates the state. I said, what do you mean she hates the state? Well, the green and white. She just doesn't like green and white. So it's a good thing we live in Ann Arbor, I guess, because she likes blue and yellow. But I'm just amazed at the size of, I mean, I've taught at Toledo on and off for just as a visiting writer for a few years, and you know, I did my graduate work in Montana, which is not a huge school, and I can't get over the size of these, both these institutions. I mean, it's just amazing. Just the English department alone at the U of M is, I mean, the support staff is about as big as the entire department, I think, at Toledo, just the assistants and secretaries and so forth. And then just to get office keys, I had to stand in line. It's an industry just making keys for that campus. They must have 4 or 5 employees full-time just in this little room making keys. And I'm sure it's the same thing up here, you know, because this is at least that big. Kind of impressive. And that they're so close together, you know, it's pretty amazing. I wanted to talk a little bit about the writing of The Jazz Bird before I read from it. It's set in the 20s, and it's based on a true story. It's the first novel I wrote, I've ever written based on reality, directly on reality. And it's still fiction. I mean, I approached the project from the beginning as a novel, not as a historical project, so that in my mind, the history was always there to serve the story and not the other way around, which is why I'm a novelist and not a historian, I guess. But when I first started, I knew I wanted to set something in the 20s, and I thought it would be just something I made up. I originally thought I would set it near Detroit somewhere because there was so much prohibition activity, smuggling activity going on. But I came across, several times I came across a short versions of the story of George Remus, which is an amazing story. you know, this lawyer from Chicago who, in his midlife crisis, moved to Cincinnati at the very beginning of Prohibition, and within a few years had grossed tens of millions of dollars because he figured out the secret to Prohibition, to the end run around Prohibition, which was that it was still legal to sell whiskey, even under the Volstead Act, as if it was medicine, if it was packaged as medicine, and if it was sold through a pharmacy. He had been a pharmacist as a young man. His uncle in Chicago owned several pharmacies, and from the age of 13, George worked in these pharmacies and then went to law school in his 20s. So by the time he was 42 or whatever, when Volstead came in, he read the act very carefully and realized that pharmaceutical wholesalers, pharmaceutical corporations, could buy very large quantities of whiskey. It was limited to a percentage of their business, 10 or 20%, but if it was a huge company doing a lot of business, that still amounted to a lot of whiskey. So what he began, and he came to Cincinnati because it was the center, was within 100 miles of something like 80% of the distilleries in the country. And remember that all these distilleries now were shuttered. They were locked up. The families that owned them were largely bankrupted. And you had to go through government agents to get whiskey out. And the only way you could get it out was to present coupons, essentially, from the government, which were issued to pharmaceutical corporations that allowed them to take out so much whiskey per month. Well, they weren't selling that much of it, you know, in little patent medicine bottles through pharmacies, so they had a lot of these certificates left over. So the first thing Remus did was he began buying these certificates for pennies from these corporations, the excess that they had, and buying the whiskey then, taking the whiskey out, and instead of selling it through pharmacies, he sold it into the black market. He spent somewhere in the range of $10 to $15 a case when you count the certificate and the cost of the whiskey, and his men were selling it on the street for $120 a case. His net to them was, his gross to them, his wholesale price to them was $80 a case. In 3.5 years, he sold 1 million cases like that. So that's a gross of $80 million, back when that was real money. He banked somewhere around $10 million of that. Estimated that he spent $25 million in graft, in bribes. And that was the secret to his success. He was a bloodless gangster, which also fascinated me. He, if he wanted somebody to do something, he would simply throw enough money at them that they would finally eventually do it. I mean, even when people came to kill him, which they did, his men would stop them, and instead of killing them, they would pay them enough money to come over to his side. His two partners, who were back, you know, working behind his back and trying to put him out of business, he ended up giving them like $1 million to go away instead of killing him. And they did. They not only went away, but they set up shop in New York and started buying his whiskey and sending it. You know, he was sending it to New York. He was quite a businessman. But to begin with, for some reason, in addition to the Cincinnati papers, the St. Louis papers also covered him very heavily. And after he went to jail in the mid-20s for whiskey crimes. And when he got out, he was very bitter, which I'll explain in a minute. But he did a whole series of interviews with some reporters from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. He had some doings in St. Louis, and so he was a fairly well-known figure there, too. These articles ran, I think, in early 26, and I saw a reference to them in several of these books that I was reading, and I wanted to find this series of articles. It was a huge set of interviews. Basically, it ran an entire newspaper page and a half every day for about 2 weeks, which is a lot of inches, of column inches. And I wanted to see these interviews. So I called the St. Louis paper, and I talked to somebody put me through to the research department, and the guy there I spoke with, a very nice guy, said, I'm ashamed to say this, but our papers from the 20s have disintegrated. They're gone. They've just rotted away. They weren't taken care of, and they've disappeared. And I said, you know, it's unbelievable, it's terrible. But he said, I do know that they're down here in the St. Louis Public Library on film, if you want to come to St. Louis, which I didn't really want to do. And then just as an afterthought, he said, you know, Michigan State used to have a big journalism department. It might be worth a call up there just to see if they might have this. And so I called up here to this library, and they did. And so I drove up here. I spent several days up here in this building and found not only those that series of interviews with him, but other pieces that had been done on him, excuse me, earlier, and you know, through the magic of video of copying and everything else, within a few days, I was able to crank out a huge stack of research materials that I could take home and highlight and work over. I mean, it was just terrific, and that was really the point at which I knew I had hold of the story, that I could make a book out of this, because it was just a great wealth of information. I then later spent time, of course, in Cincinnati. Researching later parts of the story, But this really was where I knew that I had a story. So it's kind of funny. I don't think I've been back in this building since I did that research. So I have to read from the book now that I'm here. Just to tell you the arc of the story, in real life, what actually happened was that Remus, when he came to Cincinnati, he left his wife, who was several years older than him, and left his daughter, gave her half of his money, which at that time still, he was not a poor man. He was a successful lawyer. He gave her $50,000 and kept $50,000 for himself and took his secretary with him. Her name was Imogene. She was also, she was divorced also and had a daughter. He had been having an affair with her and asked her to go to Cincinnati with him, and she said, I will if you marry me. So he did. I didn't think that was much of a romance, and I knew that if I wanted this book to work, I wanted it to be a romance. So I changed Imogene's character quite a bit. I made her into a younger woman and also from a much different place in society than Remus. Remus was a German immigrant, and as such at that time, he was money aside, he was part of an underclass, especially after the First World War. Germans were treated pretty badly. Cincinnati, for instance, changed all the names, the German street names, to English names after the war, closed all the German beer gardens. The Germans there in that city believed firmly that Prohibition was really aimed at them, that it was a way to punish the Germans in America because of the war. In any case, I made her a society girl from Cincinnati. Her father, a lawyer that Remus dealt with in his dealings in Cincinnati. And the section that I want to read from the book is when they first meet, when they first start their relationship. So she's very different in the book than she was in real life. But that's really how that story happened. What happened later then, after he made all this money, he got arrested for whiskey crimes, he went to prison, it was a 2-year sentence, he went to a federal penitentiary in Atlanta. Really, all he had to do was serve out his sentence, get out. He would have had more money than anybody needed to live on at that time. He would have, you know, he had somewhere between $5 and $10 million in bank accounts all over the state of Ohio. But before he went into prison, he wanted his wife to keep the business going, although it was one of these businesses that nobody could run but him because it was just Byzantine in its complexity. Even his vice presidents or his henchmen, his top guys, he had divided up so that they didn't know what was going on between them. So he signed over to her, to Imogene, power of attorney, so that she had control of everything, of all the business and all the bank accounts and so forth. When he started out to prison, he, of course, bribed the warden down there and had a couple of cells together, all of which was filled with his clothes on racks and the other of which had a bed and, so forth, and he would have dinner every night with the warden. His personal chef came down and stayed there with him, so the warden got some nice meals out of it, too. This went on for about 6 months until the Justice Department found out what was going on. Then the warden ended up starting to do time in the same prison, and Remus's time got harder, at which point he realized he didn't want to be in prison anymore. So he sent his wife, Imogene, to negotiate with a federal agent named Frank Dodge. This is before the FBI. They were just called Justice Department agents, there were Treasury agents and there were Justice Department agents. Dodge was with the Justice Department. This is right when Hoover started. She went to negotiate with Dodge to try to get Remus out. The deal was going to be that he was going to testify against other people, something like that. He just wanted to cut his time short. But what ended up happening, much to his surprise and chagrin, just before he was released, he did get out a little bit early. He got out about 6 months early. But he found out that Imogene and Dodge had run off together. He was served with divorce papers about a week before he was released. And of course, when he got out, the money that she had had all the access to was gone. The house was boarded up. The artwork was gone. The cars had been sold. The distilleries had been sold, other than the ones she was still running herself with Frank Dodge, who'd resigned from the Justice Department. Remus, needless to say, was enraged. This is what kicked off the whole series of interviews that I came up here to read. About a year and a half after that, he ended up doing another year in jail in Ohio, and then he got out of that prison and was pretty, I mean, the whole question of the book really in the end is a question of his sanity. What did this do to him? Because what happened on a morning in October of 1927, the morning of their divorce, she left her hotel, which is up on a hill over Cincinnati, and you come down through Eden Park into the downtown. When her driver pulled away from the hotel, Remus was following them. His driver was following her car very closely, and it turned into a chase. And they went down into the park very quickly. It's a really steep hill there. And around a turn, her car went off the road, This is in rush hour traffic, though, so there were cars everywhere in this park. If you've ever been there, there's just one or two roads that go through the park, and there's a roundabout right in the middle by the reservoir. Her car went off the road. He jumped out, ran to the car. She got out of the car and started to run, and he grabbed her and put a gun into her stomach and shot her one time. She fell and got up again, ran back through the car. She's bleeding all over the place. Somebody else got into a car with her. In real life, her daughter was actually with her. In the book, it's a friend of hers, Laura, who you'll see in this chapter that I'm going to read. And they drove her down to the city, and she died about 2 hours later. There were about 120 witnesses to the crime, so there was never any question. You know, I mean, I love it that people call this book a mystery. Like, what's the mystery, you know? I mean, on the first page, he kills her. There's no whodunit here. It's really, like any novel, it's a whydunit, you know, but... That's sort of where the book begins. I mean, so the arc of this story is huge, and the problem I had, the difficulty in writing this novel was lassoing it, you know, was getting all this under control in a way that would make a novel. So it begins just after in the moments after he shot her, and begins with him turning himself into the police and going to trial. The other interesting aspect of all this is that the prosecutor in this case was a guy named Charlie Taft, who was the second son of William Howard Taft, who had been the president, of course, and was at this time the Supreme Court Chief Justice. His older brother, Robert, was running the newspaper in Cincinnati, and Charlie had been, at the age of 29, the youngest elected chief prosecuting attorney in Hamilton County. This was a huge case for him, and he knew going into it that if he lost this case, it would severely hurt his political career. He didn't see how he could lose the case because he had those 120 witnesses, right? But Remus, luckily for himself, Remus was a defense lawyer, and his first statement to the press the day after he killed this woman was, it was justifiable homicide. That was the term he used. In other words, she needed killing, you know. And he was going to go to court with that and defend himself. He would have been found himself in the electric chair maybe 3 months later. Luckily for him, he ended up hiring another defense attorney who told him there was no such thing as a justifiable homicide if it wasn't in self-defense, which it clearly wasn't. And the only way he could possibly get out of it was to plead insanity, which had not been done very often at that point. And so it really became a huge show trial and an important trial legally. Not the first insanity defense, certainly. He himself, as a lawyer, had used that defense 15 years earlier. And not the biggest trial of the 20s by any means either. There were some crazy trials during that decade. But in any case, it was one of the big ones. And how that played out in court forms half the book. The other half of the book is the story. The trial is used as a springboard to go back in time and tell the story, the love story that leads up to the killing. So that by the end of the book, you get up to the point where he kills her and also to the end of the trial where you find out what happens to him. And it's told in three voices, Remus's voice, Charlie Taft's voice, and then I had written a number of chapters early on. I didn't really understand the structure of the book. And I wrote from Imogene's point of view, and I liked her voice very much. Of the three, it's my favorite. But the problem I had after I hit upon the structure of the book, which is that it begins after she's dead, was that I had all these chapters in her voice, but she was dead. So I just invented a device. I had Charlie Taft discover a series of journals and letters that she had written. And those are used when he becomes, in the course of the novel, he becomes kind of obsessed with Imogene and really finding out not just what happened, but really who she was. And so he begins to read pieces of these journals, and then it kicks into chapters that go back then in her voice and tells you the sections that she's that he's reading. So this is a short chapter, and it's the section where she first comes into contact with Remus. I'll just read the short journal section that Charlie Taft reads, and then the pages from this chapter. Excuse me. Monday, March 15th, 1920. I need to walk, especially when I can't help being in this city, to be out of the stuffiness in the air, the rain, the light, to breathe. Sometimes Laura walks with me. After I retrieve her from father's offices, we window shop along the Eastern Row, then walk west into the city center. Traffic is terribly heavy, streams of motor cars and horse carriages and the electric streetcars, and I wonder sometimes what will happen one day when it all just gets so busy no one can move. So this chapter is called A Fine Bordeaux. Farther north they went, sometimes clear to the Findlay Market, past the hawking vendors with their carts of fruit or bread or fish or flowers or vegetables, and the people shouting and dealing and trading and carrying baskets of the goods they'd purchased. Sometimes they spent the entire time just walking, hungry only for talk, and sometimes not even that, for Laura knew everything, more even than father and mother, so what need was there to talk of it? So much was in the past now, receding faster and faster each day into history where it would stay forever. But what the past had wrought had left her here, alone but bound, frustrated, unhappy. I should say that Imogene, in my version, is actually married, although her husband was injured in the war badly in the brain, and so he's in an asylum. So she's essentially married, constrained from doing anything with her life, and yet unmarried because he's in a coma. Sometimes she felt sorry for herself. She told Laura she was horrible and spoiled, and Laura should just tell her to stop it, and sometimes Laura did. Laura was 5 years older. She was 30, and she'd worked for Imogene's father for 10 years. From the beginning, when Imogene was still practically a girl, Imogene had worshipped her, and Laura had taken her in, shared confidences, listened. It had changed between them, of course, as Imogene grew up and found her place in the world, which was a very different place than Laura's, but they had remained close, and there were still things Imogene told Laura that no one else knew. On Wednesday, it was to be the Sinton. Good food, sublime food, was as much a release sometimes as walking. She arrived at the offices at noon. Laura was finishing something, so she sat outside the oak balustrade where the clients waited. She had a view back into the conference room where this new client, George Remus, sat alone, writing, waiting, no doubt, for Father. She knew from the way Father spoke of Remus that he was pleased to have him, which simply meant that Remus would generate plenty of income. He was in some lucrative business or other. A radiator hissed, and high overhead a wooden fan forced the heated air back down, but it already felt hot and dry. Outside, a streetcar passed loudly, and in its wake, the sounds of traffic, the wheezy percolations of motor cars, the clacking of hooves and the heavy rumble of wagons, the voices of the pedestrians who risked their very lives passing through it all, rose together and were amplified in the high-domed plaster and wood overhead. She watched Mr. Remus working, when suddenly he looked up at her, directly into her eyes. She looked away for a moment, then back. She smiled, and he nodded. He continued to look. She did not feel that she could look away. It was rude to stare, but he seemed to imply nothing by it, nor did he seem self-conscious. He just looked, regarding, as if he was thinking of something far away, as if they were both far away, someplace else altogether. Imogene, a word? It was her father. She followed him back, rolling her eyes at Laura as she passed. Laura smiled. He shut his office door and said, 1 a.m., Father, and your mother tells me she smelled liquor on your clothing and cigarette smoke. Does it strike you as odd that Mother sniffs my clothing? It does me. Imogene, he said, you're out with these sorts of people who, just because it's illegal now, she said. She knew he kept bottles of it locked away in his study. It's not the legality, he said, but the sort of person who drinks it in public, who goes to these places. I don't know what you mean, she said. I go to hear the music. I'm certainly not getting drunk, if that's what you're asking. Music. He didn't even like her to play rags on the piano at home. He said, you have a station in this city, Imogene. You've suffered a terrible tragedy, but it doesn't excuse this sort of thing. And now that you're living under my roof again, perhaps I shouldn't. Don't be insolent. I'm just asking you to have a little courtesy, to show a little decency. That's all. Someone knocked, then immediately opened the door. It was this man, Remus. I apologize, he said, but I'm pressed, Alfred. If I could leave this, perhaps you could ring me. Yes, yes, Ring said, of course. Leave it with Laura, will you? Remus hung in the doorway a moment, looking at her. He simply stared, as he had before. She felt compelled to say something, but as she opened her mouth, he shut the door. New client, her father said. So you've said. You should have introduced us. He's no one you want to meet. Really? No, in fact, no. I see, she said. Just please think about what I've said, Imogene. I know how difficult it's been. No, Father, she said, you don't. But I won't go anymore. A lie. But God, she couldn't stand to listen to him sometimes. The last thing I want is to make you and Mother uncomfortable. Outside, she slipped her arm through Laura's as they walked. So, Laura said, what did the mysterious Mr. Remus have to say? Why, nothing at all. I think he's a bit rude. The Grand Cafe in the Sinton Hotel was her favorite, especially with Laura, though Laura couldn't afford it too often. It was not the fact of being seen there, of rubbing shoulders with the right ladies in the right hats. She loved the staff, the assuredness of a waiter's hand, the slight crackling of his starched sleeve, the white gloves of the captain, Jean, who knew her, of course, and bowed just slightly. She loved the food, the grilled lamb chops or the roasted tenderloin or the smoked salmon, always perfect and always too much, so she and Laura split the main course. She loved the room itself, the high ceiling with its colored glass skylight and the corner pillars of terracotta embedded with rookwood tiles and the huge painted murals high up on the walls and the marble squares of the floor. It all seemed to dampen unnecessary noise so that you could talk and not be overheard, your words rising straight up into the air. Jean, who was French, bowed and the headed ladies looked up. Jean showed them to the back of the high open room, to a corner banquette where you sat to eat and talk, but not to be seen. The special today was a brioche of capon livers with new peas. They ordered that. Normally, she didn't care much for chicken liver, but the way they sauteed it and then tucked it into the crumbly crust with sweet onions and peppers and spices was wonderful, and she knew Laura loved it. Laura spread white butter on a piece of the good warm bread. I miss the Bordeaux, she said. They had always split a bottle, which was a little much for lunch, but once a month it was a fine thing to do. Then in January, Prohibition came in. They could probably get you some, Imogene said. I mean, who would care? They wouldn't, Laura said. They can't. Imogene waved at Jean. What if you get caught, said Laura. What do they do to you? Oh, not much, I hear, a fine or something. Jean came over and leaned down. We so miss the wine, Imogene said. Is it at all possible? I'm sorry, Madame, Jean said. Imogene smiled and nodded. Laura sipped at her tea, which was not Bordeaux, and said, he is very mysterious, though, isn't he? Remus, I mean. Are we still talking about him? No one knows exactly what it is he does. I'm sure he's just another boring businessman, Laura. They say he's a criminal. Imogene laughed. I know this, Laura said. He works at all kinds of strange hours. Your father has people running halfway through the night up to his rooms here. Here, Imogene said, he lives at the Sinton? Oh, yes, in a suite. He doesn't even have a proper office. I hear he's quite well off, but they say all he does is work. He's obsessed with it. It's just that no one knows what it is. The order came. The smell of the liver with its spices was so rich she felt the saliva run in her mouth, and she wasn't even particularly hungry. But even if she had been, she could have simply breathed in that smell, and it would have been enough. Jean made sure the waiter set the dish between them and that they each got a clean white plate. When it was ready, he served, lifting the delicate slices of brioche with serving forks and setting them on the plates, then lifting the onion and other bits of goodness, too, and setting that on the slices. As they ate, Jean came back carrying a white porcelain teapot. He nodded at the waiter, who cleared away the identical one already on their table and their cups and set down clean ones. Courtesy of the gentleman, Jean said, and nodded toward the arched entranceway where Remus stood watching them. Imogene said, I don't understand. Jean poured. The tea that came out had the hue of Venus blood. Jean said softly, a fine Bordeaux. He held his hand out, palm down, to indicate the desirability of discretion, and said, bon appétit. Imogene looked again at the doorway, but it was empty now. All right. We've got some time. You want to hear more of that or something from the new one? Or do you want to ask me a bunch of questions? Well, we'll do that later. We'll do questions later. Let me read. What should I read? Since nobody's read this, or most of you haven't read this, I'm going to read another piece of this from a little earlier, from Remus's perspective. This is a section. Pretty self-explanatory. It's just when he gets to jail after he shot Imogene. It's near the beginning of the book. The way these voices work in this book, though, Imogene's voice is as I said, generated from the journal selections that Charlie's reading. And in my mind, it was always a kind of an impressionistic view of things, you know. Charlie Taft's view in this book is not at all impressionistic. It's a lawyer's view. It's straightforward and objective. And it gets more interesting as he gets more obsessed with her. Remus's view, Remus's voice came out almost And sometimes it was almost surreal in a way, the way his, he was kind of, it was hard to capture him because, you know, he went to trial with a defense of insanity. He claimed publicly he wasn't insane. He had a great fear of being labeled insane. And yet there was some suggestion that maybe he was sort of unbalanced. And then there were other suggestions that he was really canny and that it was all an act. And I mean, at one point in the trial, he actually, when they were testifying about somebody coming to kill him, he fell on the floor and started screaming and moaning and clutching at himself. And, you know, these doctors all ran over to help him. And the prosecutors just looked at him and shook their heads. And they figured it was all just an act, you know. And nobody knows for sure. So in the writing, I wasn't, you know, it was sort of all of that mixed up together. Here's this very brilliant guy, this great legal mind, who also has just shot his wife to death, has maybe thrown his life away. You know, what's the mental state of that? So this is a section that happens just after he's in prison. Let me just tell you a few things about Remus himself, though, before I read this. He was, in actuality, 5'2", with a 19-inch neck. He weighed 225 pounds, and they claim there was no fat on him. He was just solid muscle. And if you see pictures of him, he looks just like a square. I mean, he's just huge in the shoulders. He was a marathon swimmer most of his life. He would go to swim meets in the Ohio River and the Mississippi River and the lakes and swim, you know, miles and miles and miles. Immensely powerful and could be, you know, become enraged. He had, you know, literally hand-to-hand combat with other bootleggers trying to raid his trucks. This guy who didn't need to protect a truckload of whiskey would leap off these trucks and just lay into these guys swinging and trying to hit them and shoot them or whatever. So I use that also. I mean, the whole notion of his being this sort of marathon swimmer. Again, this scene is partially invented, but I think it begins to get it. It's trying to get at this complex psychology. This chapter is called The Swimmer. In the evening, they moved him from a holding cell in the precinct house to the county jail on the upper floors of the courthouse. Now, in the night, alone, he wondered where everyone was. He had lawyers. Then he remembered that they had quit, the last of them, in exasperation at his endless criticism. But surely someone should have come. Of course, most of them were gone now. Marcus and Stratton and Landau and Hess and Giram were gone. Zolene and Jess Smith and President Harding, Fowler, the valet, all gone. But Connors was not gone. Babe was not gone. At least he didn't think so. He remembered Babe driving him into the park, and that when he'd looked around later, the car was gone. Babe must have got scared and ran. Well, good for him. Remus hoped Babe was out there in the world running still. He had a cell to himself, a wooden bench, a single blanket, wool but thin, no pillow, no mattress or sheets upon the hard bench. The brick walls glowed cold. His shoulder especially ached. Sitting up took some pressure off it. He wedged himself into a corner and dozed and woke back and up into damp darkness, shivering harder and aching more deeply as the night wore on. At one of her magnificent parties, the bright lighting made his eyes water. He looked at all the fine people in their fine clothing. He stood at the head of a table as long as a tennis court and held up a glass. The guests grew silent. He offered them well-chosen words of hope and good cheer. They smiled and offered their glasses to him. The staff brought the food then, course after course of finely wrought delicacies in the form of wide flat bowls of a swirled orange and yellow soup, twisted knuckles of warm breads, selections of delicate and exotic appetizers. He could name none of them, though she had told him half a dozen times the names of each. It mattered to her to name what they had constructed, to name each particular element of it, as if by so doing, by cataloging and ordering, it could somehow be preserved. Escargot, he remembered then, chewy grubs marinated in hot garlic butter and threaded back into perfect shells. He had laughed at this indulgence, the stuffing of dead mollusks into new shells, so that one could simply have the pleasure of taking the tiny fork in hand and pulling them out again, of feeling the slight suck of the vacuum they had formed. God, he was cold. He'd always lived for the cold, for the waters of the black nights. But this creeping, insidious jailhouse chill was not that. You needed to move. If you could move, you could let it pull you in and just go where it took you and come out better for it at the end. Once it had been the pier by the grounds of the Old World's Fair in South Chicago. As he shed the heavy woolen trousers and jacket his mother still dressed him in, though he was nearly 14, he gazed out across the unbounded expanse of it. The flat gray swells rose and fell as if the whole thing were some breathing, many-lunged creature, each lung expanding and contracting separately but in complex synchronicity. He'd never tried it this early. Small flows of ice still dotted the surface. As he walked from the pier toward the stone breakwater to the north, his feet left scalloped depressions in the dirty sand. In the summer, he could swim for 2 hours, but now it would be enough just to make it from the breakwater to the pier, a quarter of a mile. Nothing, really, except in this cold. The lake slapped at the end of the wall. The perpetual wind, frigid, heavy with moisture, whipped about him. He shivered, breathing, looking, nothing, nothing, his mind blank in the way he could make it. He dove. Oh, the ice of it, the blinding, numbing frigidity. The gray water hugged him to its bosom, sucked him down, and squeezed him as his mother did sometimes, so tightly he couldn't breathe. His mind dimmed. He saw sparkles, then darkness, until the ice shot through clear to his spine, to his heart and brain and the core of his gut, and burned, and he came back. He broke through a swell into the gray light, into the air. The swells lifted him. The great gray city, his city, Chicago, lay before him. A rail ran along the shoreline, the steam from a locomotive coming toward him. Farther up, haze rolled from the mouth of the river, from the factories and foundries and refineries that lined it. Beyond that, he could not see, but he knew what was there, the green money haze of Lincoln Park, the part of the city that did not belong to him, not yet. He broke toward the pier, arms cutting, legs grinding, face turning between the lighter gray of the air and the darker gray of the water. He swam to stay alive, but halfway across he knew he wasn't going to make it. He felt his muscles locking up, and he suddenly couldn't breathe. He stopped and trod, gasping, looking up at the dimming sky. He had never been so frightened. He imagined his body, gray now as the water, slowly sinking, spinning to the eternal warmth at the bottom. That vision made him move against the pain. Then he forgot where he was, forgot how to breathe, and inhaled the fishy, greasy water and choked. Then he was crawling onto the pier's rough planking. The water he vomited steamed on the wood. He felt hands rubbing him, a coat thrown over him. Crazy damn kid. A man walking in the fairgrounds had seen him go in. The man rubbed until George began to feel his arms again, until he could walk back to the bench and get dressed. He looked back out over the gray water. "You try that again," the man said. "They'll be tossing the hooks for you." He knew he'd had no business going in. He loved to swim, but that hadn't been why. It was something else, a thing he needed to understand, to try, to know he could do. He was alive. He hid a smile. His arms and his legs burned as the blood and the feeling returned. I mentioned this flashes back to one of the parties that they had in the mansion, and that's based on reality. He threw fabulous parties for people. That was not such an uncommon thing at that time. You know, all the sort of robber barons were sort of known for these, you know, bizarrely expensive parties they had. But Remus was up there toward the top. He early on, he would do things like put $100 bills under everybody's dinner plate. And then when they would discover them, they would, $100 was like $1,000 now. So they would always get these elaborate gifts, you know, watches or whatever. And the last party he threw before he went to prison the first time for the whiskey violations, some of the histories claim that it was on New Year's Eve and some that it was at another time, but it was near the end. So in the book, it's on New Year's Eve. And the party goes all night long. The other interesting thing about Remus is that he was a complete teetotaler. He never drank in his life and never smoked, and had actually a special room constructed in the mansion so that other people at the parties could go and smoke without bothering him. And he would have apple juice in a glass, a clear glass, so that it would look like whiskey, because he didn't want people to think he wouldn't drink his own whiskey. But this party went on all night, and he spent much of it in the library reading and drinking milk. And then at the end, in the morning, he had a big breakfast for everyone before they went home, and there was a present in front of each pair of settings. And the women all grabbed these presents and opened them, thinking it was some diamond or something. I mean, one party he threw, he actually bought the entire contents of a jewelry store and gave it to all the women at the party. And when they opened them, they were all presents for the men. They were tie tacks and things like that. And these women were sort of upset that they hadn't gotten something. And then when they went outside to leave, there were 100 couples at this party. When they went outside to leave, there were 100 new 1927 Pontiacs lined up in the driveway, one for each woman at the party. That's a true story. I don't know what that would have cost, but it's amazing. I mean, so the women went home with new cars, and Remus went off to prison and lost everything. Any questions about the book? Well, do you want me to ruin the end for you?
Okay.
I can tell you if you want to talk about it. Okay.
I think I know what happened. I got out of law school in 1992. Mm-hmm. Going through Cincinnati, and I discovered very fast that there were two groups of people, the past people and the non-past people.
Right. Right. That's why he was still in Cincinnati in 1957, right?
Yeah.
He was the mayor then, wasn't he?
I don't know.
Sometime in through there, he.
Yeah.
Anyway.
And what happened to Dodge?
You know, I don't know.
Well,
he's from Lansing. I was going to say that's the other connection up here is that they think a lot of the money that went out of Remus's accounts came up here. His father was still up here, and he had connections up here. And he actually had some people that came down in trucks and moved a lot of the goods from the mansion back up here. So a lot of it could have ended up in Lansing. But I never found out beyond that. And I don't know how much of it he got and how much of it she kept or whether it was all just, you know, blown away with the winds. But apparently a good amount of it did come up this way. Somebody asked me about that the last time I was up here.
And there was a story about that the owner,
is that right, to Frank Dodge? Right, exactly. So it became the Dodge Building. That sounds entirely plausible. The other thing that's interesting about the name is that a lot of the Dodge stuff that you see, especially as you get toward Detroit, is from the car Dodges. I mean, there are those, but this was apparently not. I mean, this was was it a house or was it an office building?
Office building.
Oh, because was there a mansion too?
Yeah, there was a Dodge mansion.
Yeah. Okay, it was a different. So the Dodge, see now I hadn't heard that. I hadn't heard that about the Dodge Building though. That's interesting. Huh. And I, you know, the story doesn't go beyond that. But where that money went, as far as I know, is still a mystery. I know Remus spent a lot of energy having people go around breaking open or getting into safe deposit boxes that she had taken out, thinking he was going to find lots of cash stashed. And all he ever found was papers mostly, you know, books and things. So he didn't find out. I mean, it wasn't like he was completely bankrupted either. He had a number of pseudonymous accounts, so he still had money. But it wasn't, you know, the bulk of it was gone. So that's interesting. I did a reading at the Mercantile Library in Cincinnati when this book came out, which is the oldest private library in the country. You join this library, and you can go there. It's right in the middle of the downtown. And they have a literary lunch every month, which they give little box lunches to people that come in to watch. I mean, Melville read there. That's how old this library is. They have his name up. And there were all these lawyers, these men in suits and ties, you know, in the audience, older men. The people that down there that tended to come to these readings were really either really, really old people who remembered Remus. And I met a number of them. As kids, they remembered the trial. One woman said her grandmother called him Dirty Remus. And or their dads had been, and one guy was just went on and on about him, and he must have been 80, and he said, my dad was a judge, and he's the one that first, you know, heard that something. I didn't get the story, but he was somehow involved in some part of the situation. And then there were these men who were sort of the next generation down, and afterwards they all came up and shook my hand and said that they were all from the Taft Law Firm and had known Charlie and just came to see what the story was, you know, what this book was about. It was really something, though. But he was a well-known character, and he died in the 80s, so he was around for a long time. But, yeah, his political career never went beyond. He was on the city council, I think, and became the mayor at one point, I think in the 50s, and then that was about it. And his brother, Robert, had a huge political career in Washington, you may know. He was called Mr. Republican, and he was a senator, the Senate Majority Leader, for years and years and years, nominated. I'm not sure if he ran for the presidency or didn't get the nomination, but he was very powerful in the Senate. And his son, then, Robert Jr., was also a senator, and his son, Robert III, is now the governor of Ohio, so that dynasty carries on to this day. So it's just interesting how these things turn. What else? Yes?
I have a question kind of pertaining to the way you write about your characters. How is it different for you to write about, like, George Remus, who actually existed in these people, as opposed to, like, a character that you create for fiction?
That's a good question. And when I began this book, I thought it was going to be the easiest book I had done because I had the whole story laid out. Usually the hard part for me is figuring out really what is the story. My stories tend to be fairly intricate, and I don't outline. I just sort of figure them out. And this one, I had all the pieces to it. And so I wrote a draft or half a draft of a novel, It didn't work, and I realized, you know, Remus was going to have to be different, and that's when I really realized Imogene was going to have to become my own character. But the answer to your question is that in the end, these characters have to become mine. In other words, I have to absorb all the history and all the stuff that I read, and then somehow just let it digest itself and be there. But in the end, I think that the way I look at Remus in my mind is not much different than the way I look at my other characters. You know, I create the story, and once I have the story, I can write the characters. And I needed to change them some from reality in order for them to become my characters. So like I say, a lot of these scenes are based on things that happened, but the details are, like the swimming scene with him, I don't know if that ever happened, but I know he was a swimmer, and I know he was from Chicago. I mean, there were stories that he went down as a kid and swam in the lake. So you know, I would use that as a sort of a jumping off point. But in the end, they needed to become my characters, or I couldn't write them. And the same thing finally happened with Charlie Taft. He was originally just going to be the sort of the objective storytelling voice of the book. But as I wrote it, as I said before, he got more obsessed with this dead woman, Imogene, to the point in the book that his wife actually gets very upset with him and leaves for a while because he's so obsessed with tracking down the history of this woman. I don't know if that ever happened either. I doubt if it did. But it made him become my character, you know, in a way that he wasn't before that. And I can see it in the writing. As soon as it clicks, it starts to come off the page, you know. But it takes a long time to get to that point. That's why this book took 3 years to write. So. Are you a writing student? It's a good question. Imogene was, both in real life and in the novel, a manipulator, and not just an innocent woman who was shot to death in the street. Not that she deserved that, but she was a pretty complex character and a pretty gray one, you know what I mean? I mean, she had some dark side to her, too. So I don't know if I sympathize with one any more than the other. There's a line at the end of the book that says something, you know, when Remus is in his old age, how what he ended up having to do was much more difficult than what she had to do, simply because she died and he lived, and it was a hard thing. She would probably disagree with that, you know, if she had the chance. I don't know. I really identified with them both in different ways. I mean, I could clearly see from his perspective the emotional how emotionally destroyed he must have been and what led him to the moment of killing her. And that's an interesting moment. I was looking, I was watching TV during the process of this, and there was one of those news shows, you know, 2020 or one of those, yeah. And they did a section on a case, I think it was from Kalamazoo, from the cold case file, which is now a whole series, I guess. But this was a real, you know, it was an actual case that happened in Kalamazoo. There was a woman who was who disappeared, housewife, and they, you know, the cops always know right away who did it. They just either can prove it or they can't prove it. And they figured that the husband was involved, but they never had anything on him. And they went back some years later. The cold case team got this case. This, maybe it happened in the early 90s, and this was in the late 90s. And they went back to the house where they had lived, and they started doing scans, and they found that the bathroom had been painted, and under the paint was blood all over the walls, the residue of this blood. And so they just started turning up evidence, and they went down. They tracked this guy down to Florida, and one of the detectives went down to talk to him. And he said as soon as he sat down with the guy started to cry and confessed. Like, he thought he would at least have to trick him into... Guy had just been waiting there for years for them to come down. And when they interviewed him on TV in prison, this guy was crying, and he kept saying, but I loved her, but I loved her, but I loved her. And I thought, you know, that's the moment right there. Because I don't think these kinds of killings happen out of just anger or just hatred. I think there's this bizarre combination of intense love and intense anger and hatred and frustration. And that emotional moment was so complex that I could see Remus's getting to that point, you know, this very powerful guy who's just sort of reduced to this moment of rage. And there's a moment in the courtroom where he blows up, where Charlie Taft thinks to himself, that's how he did it to her. It's not insanity, it's this kind of rage. And he was known to throw these fits of rage. He just trashed things. I mean, when he got back to the mansion and found out that she had gone, he was hitting holes in the wall. You know, literally punching his fist through wall. Then these weren't drywall. These was like old plaster walls, you know. He would tear his hair out in lawyers. They had testimony of lawyers saying he would literally tear his hair out in their offices trying to, you know, when she left him. I mean, he was so enraged. He was just, is that insanity or not? But to answer your question, it wasn't one or the other. It was really both that I identified with. And the voices are different, and I think that they come across that way. I think that's, in the end, why the book got written in three different voices, because I identified with these three characters in different ways. You know, other books, it's one character, and that becomes the voice of the book. But in this case, it was equal in some sense. Who else? You don't have to just ask about the book, too, if you just want to ask questions about writing or publishing. I worked in... This book is, it's a very different sort of novel than Remus. It's set in the late 70s, mostly, which I don't consider historical quite, but some people may. It's interesting, it's just long enough ago that things have changed just enough that it's kind of got this old sense to it, and yet it's not. I mean, you know, detail by detail, it's not that different, but then every once in a while I come up against something that's just things. Just it's just interesting what's evolved in 25 years, which is about when this is set. It's written in the first person, so it's a very different kind of voice than Remus, and it's essentially the story is from the perspective of a young man, a pre-medical student, who it's called The Narcissist's Daughter, who works in a hospital lab and ends up having an affair with the wife of the guy that runs the lab, and then finds out in the course of this that he is actually involved in something other than just an affair with her, that there's more going on than he realized. And his reaction to that, his sort of rage and anger and what he does from that is what drives the story. But it's really very different. It's almost, in my mind, it's almost like a dark comedy, I think. I mean, I really find this book... You know, by dark comedy, I don't mean a laugh-out-loud comedy, but a book that's just a different take on this persona and on these characters. And the language of it is even very different. I mean, all my books are different, though, and I think that's why my publishers are often frustrated with me, because they really want these pigeonholes, you know, to hang things, to put things in, and my books change so much. And Remus certainly was different than the ones before it, and this one is too. So it's been interesting, and I think partly the reason I wrote it is that it's involved almost no research at all. And I was just sort of researched out after Remus. I mean, I have, you know, just a huge box full of stuff, and I wanted to do something that I just could just write, a story that I could come up with. As it turns out, it's taken as long to write as Remus did, but for completely different reasons. So right now, it's scheduled, actually, for next year. It's scheduled for October of next year, so I'm racing to get a draft done so we can keep to that. They already pushed it back twice, so I'm hoping that's when it will come out. It's in Ohio, and if you look at the novel before Remus was set in a fictitious Ohio city, an unnamed Ohio city, which was intentional, and this book is in a very similar place. I find that the industrial Midwestern cities, if you look at them, all are from the same are cut very much from the same mold. That, you know, you've always got a river, and you've got the old downtown core, and then the ring of manufacturing and old city that was ghetto and now maybe is being refurbished, and then, you know, out into the suburbs. And they're so similar in so many ways. I mean, if you go to Dayton, or you go to Akron, or Flint, or Jackson, or Toledo, or whatever, Detroit, which is the archetype, that by not naming a particular city, I can sort of get all this ambiance, but not have to worry about the details of, you know, if I say it's in Youngstown, where's this street and where's that street? It just doesn't add anything to the fiction, I don't think. I mean, this book was not the case. This was very much a Cincinnati book, and it needed to spend a lot of time in Cincinnati learning the city. But some of the other books, I think they work just as well, but by just sort of having a fictional Rust Belt, you know.
I mean, given your Midwestern background, did you feel like a fish out of water being in Montana?
I tried to get some fish out of water while I was there. No, I didn't really. I love the mountains and I love the West. And I mean, it was certainly a different. You know, the ambiance was different. The thing that I think I got as much a kick out of as anything was that people would comment on my accent. And I said, I'm from Ohio, I don't have an accent. And they'd say, yeah, you do, you have an Ohio accent, you know, in this real flat Western voice. It was a nice place to live at the time. I mean, I have done a lot of stuff outdoors anyway, so I really enjoyed doing that. I did a lot of fishing and hiking while I was there. I probably would have stayed there, but there was just nothing to do career-wise. So I ended up in New York, which is quite a change too, from here and from there. No, it wasn't really. I mean, I didn't feel a culture shock or anything like that. You know, it was just really nice to be there. I'd like to do it again sometime. But I'm here. I like Michigan, actually. It's nice. It's such a various state. You know, I mean, I'm going up north in a couple of weeks to a writers' conference on Walloon Lake, which is also just, you know, so spectacular up there. It's amazing. Yes?
When you're writing, do you think that the environment that you're in affects it? Like, when do you feel you do your best writing? Is there any kind of a moment or an atmosphere that you think compels you to go at it?
It's hard to predict because it doesn't happen every day. So I write every day for that reason, because I really don't know when it's going to happen. I mean, I've thought about that a lot. I mean, I'm just finishing my fifth novel, and they've all taken a fairly long time to write. I write in the mornings. I mean, that's my schedule, is to get up and as soon as I can go to work. And I generally write only till about noon or 1 o'clock. I'm not an all-day sort of writer. Occasionally I'll go out. If I'm really in a phase of the book that's very active, where there's a lot of writing going on and I know what's happening, I might go out at night sometimes late when it's quiet and work too. But generally, I need to be pretty fresh.
But as far as what you're asking goes, you know, it's just, I really believe that much of what gets written in my head. I think this is true of a lot of writers, that the brain works on this stuff completely unconsciously. Because I'm really, not, I don't think about it. I try not to think about it. I mean, sometimes I do, but I try very hard not to think about what's going on. And I can try working on it. I can sit there and just try and try and try to write, and just nothing comes out that's any good. And then one day I'll just sit down, or even at the end of one writing session, like the last half hour, say, suddenly it will just open up, and I'll just write several pages of pretty good prose, you know, prose that I know in one form or another is going to make it into the book. And it's just unpredictable. So the only lesson from that is you just have to be there every day, because if you're not, and it happens, and you miss it, it never comes back, you know. Yes, sir.
Hemingway said that he could stop the day when the world was going to happen. Did that occur to you?
Yeah, in some sense. A lot of times it's not necessarily what's going to happen next, but what I did wrong, you know, that needs fixed the next day. But now, I guess, you know, in a broader sense, that when I know what I'm going to work on the next day. Generally, yeah. Generally, I start that way. You need to get going. I find it almost impossible to just sit down and begin where I left off and just go. He talked about he would stop sometimes in the middle. I think it was Hemingway who talked about stopping in the middle of a sentence, so that he would, you know, that would compel him to go. But then he also talked about going back and reading, and I find that I pretty much have to do that in the process of going back and reading. Previous day's work. You know, you're rewriting and rewriting. And that the other thing that happens with me is that, as I said, I work the plots of these books out very slowly, and they're fairly intricate plots, so that I'll come to a point in the writing where I know what's going to happen next, I'll outline what's going to happen next, maybe a chapter or something, I'll write notes about it, I'll have it all there, and I don't write it. I can't write it. I sit there and I can't write it, and I'll think, you know, why am I being lazy? Why am I not doing this? And always it's because there's something wrong before that in the book. And I've learned now to go back sooner than I used to. I used to spend days and days and finally realize, oh, wait a minute. Either this is wrong or there's something that needs added earlier on that affects what's coming up. And once I go back and fix that, then it just goes through again. You know, then I'll just keep going until I get to the next point like that. But again, it's an unconscious thing. It really, I don't have any sense that there's something wrong with the story, no conscious sense. But when I get stuck, I know to go back and start looking and thinking, where did I screw this up? What did I do wrong? I made an assumption that's not true, or I had a character going in a particular direction that's the wrong direction. And once I find that, then it goes forward again. So a lot of the going back is about that, structural sorts of things. But even if it's not, I still find, you know, when I write a good scene, say, a scene that I know works and that I know is going to stay there, I still need to go back through it a lot of times to make it really work. And often to flesh it out more. The first draft tends to be kind of thin sometimes, you know, just in terms of details. It goes fairly quickly. And then the writing gets richer as I go back through it. So, yeah. Else?
Mm-hmm.
I didn't really. I don't know why he was. I mean, he was very poor growing up, and his father was. Remus himself was a German immigrant. He was four or something when they came over, and he had a terribly. Tragic childhood in the sense that I think he was like the fifth child and the only one the first one that survived to adulthood. And then he had three or four brothers and sisters after him. And by the time of the trial, I think two of his sisters were still alive. So when he was a kid, most of his siblings died. He saw his brother, he had a younger brother who was playing in the street, and a wagon went by and a brick flew up and hit him in the head, and he was not killed, but he was severely retarded after that. And he couldn't, you know, function very well. So it was just a really, and they lived in a slum in Chicago. He worked for his uncle, who was much better off, but Remus's family was not well off because his father got very sick when Remus was a boy still, and that's why he had to go to work when he was 13 or 12 or 13. So he was, I have to imagine that was behind a lot of it. You know, it was just the fact that he had had such a hard, hard upbringing and that his health and his physicalness, you know, came from that. I mean, he was probably, you know, he seemed to be obsessed with it. I mean, the way he was about things. And he was also very much a person who, when he decided to do something new, just had no problems dropping everything in his life and going and doing it. He essentially forced his uncle out of the pharmacy business when he was 18 or 19 and bought the stores from his uncle, kind of pushed him into retirement and took over these stores. So he, by the age of 21, he had a very successful business. He had three stores. And at that time, pharmacists didn't just sell pharmaceuticals. They also sold eyeglasses. They ground their own lenses. And they were also essentially practicing physicians because there were no laws. So somebody would come in and say, you know, I've got this pain in my back. Pharmacists would say, well, you know, try a little of this and just prescribe over the counter. So he had a really good business and then just quit, sold them, and went to law school when he was 21 because he felt like he was bored with the pharmacy business and wanted to do something else. And as a lawyer, he was known as the Napoleon of the bar because he was so short and also because he was just a madman in the courtroom. I mean, he was found charged with contempt numerous times for screaming at judges and throwing papers. He was vehemently anti-death penalty and would just rage when his clients would end up, I mean, some of them obviously got hanged. And eventually, I think that's partly why he left the legal profession, because he just couldn't take it anymore. But he was staunchly, staunchly anti-death penalty, which is why it's interesting that he became, as I said, a bloodless gangster. You know, he was so against killing, and then in the end, he blows his wife away in the middle of the street. But which also, you know, Clarence Darrow testified at the trial and said that's your proof that he's insane right there, because he couldn't kill anyone, and then he killed her. So he had to be insane. So, you know, it's all of that. And then when he realized he wanted to go to Cincinnati, he just divorced his wife and left. It was like, you know, he didn't think twice about it. Well, here's half the money. I'll see you later. And, that must have all come from the sort of upbringing he had. I mean, that's all I ever could gather from it. So it's an interesting question, though. Anybody else? All right. Is that it? Okay. Well, thank you.